January 4th, 2007. Happy New Year's from the Image Doctors. I'm Jason Odell.
Yeah, and Rick Walker.
And I hope everyone had a safe and happy New Year's holiday.
Yeah, hopefully one that wasn't as snowy as ours has been.
Gosh, you know, we had the blizzard a couple weeks ago, and we had
yet another blizzard
last week. So fortunately this time the streets are clear enough we can get through and record our show without any trouble.
Yep.
Got a lot of things on deck for you today. Start the new year with a fresh topic. We want to talk about black and white conversion.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about using fisheye lenses.
Right.
In particular, using them with digital, the 10.5 millimeter DX fisheye that Nikon makes.
Yep.
But there's
Although,
other things, too.
Yeah, and we'll talk about the older ones as well.
And we have a tip of the day, week, month, whatever, that first tip of the new year.
Yep, which has to do with how to create a polarizer type of look in the raw conversion process.
So I take it, Rick, that you had a good, happy holidays?
Yeah, it was good.
Excellent. I just wish there wasn't so much snow out there.
Yeah, it kind of slowed us down on our R1C1 episode, didn't it?
Yeah, we're going to try to do that. We're going to have to reschedule to get out to that butterfly pavilion. When the interstates are shut down, you don't go out very far.
Yeah.
You just stay at home.
Yeah, so that's probably one that we won't have in an episode until, my guess is, sometime in early February, just because of some travel I've got coming up. So it'll be a little while, but we'll try to do a good job on that.
You're not allowed to go on vacation.
I know.
Okay.
All right.
Well, we thought we'd start off today with talking about the fisheye lenses and what they're useful for.
Right.
Other than being toys.
Sure.
To have in your collection.
Yeah. Now, let's start off by talking about the two basic types of fisheyes, one of which is not too prevalent anymore. And the original fisheyes were all the type that produced circular images on film, and those were lenses like the old Nikon 6mm, 8mm, and 10mm lenses.
The focal length is small, but the price tag is high.
It was very high, and some of those things were huge monsters with, you know, big front elements and stuff. But as I mentioned, they produced an image that didn't fill the whole frame. It was a circular one, and while it was interesting under some circumstances, it wasn't one that was easily used in a lot of photographic situations. I think they actually were originally made for doing research for astronomy and meteorology and things like that.
Interesting. And the name fisheye lens has nothing to do with the image it produced. It has to do with the appearance of the actual
It looked like
itself.
A fish's eye.
Yeah, the big bulbous front protruding element,
right,
most of the time.
Yeah.
And so that's one.
Yeah, and then the other type is called different names, but often you'll hear them called full-frame fisheyes or things like that. And they started off with a 16mm that Nikon made for a long time in different variations. And that one works very well with film. And you'll see a very distorted image, but it'll fill up the entire frame. There are no gaps. They're black. It's not a circular image. And those tend to be a lot more useful for most photographers. They're easier to handle and more universally applicable, even though fisheye shots are not the kind of thing that you want to make a whole lot of, probably.
No. One thing about, we'll start off with just using a fisheye.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these lenses, the 10.5 fisheye for digital is a good example. The field of view is usually 180 degrees.
Right.
Or pretty darn near that.
Right.
And that means there's going to be a lot of distortion on the edges. Horizon lines are going to look strange if they're not straight through the middle of the frame. So you have to find the right subject, I would say, first of all, when you're using a fisheye lens. And they work really well for landscapes or buildings when you really want a distorted effect. Sometimes you can shoot with a fisheye because you want the distorted effect. Other times, you won't even know you used a fisheye. If it's some abstract landscape, you might not even realize,
right,
that there was a fisheye.
If you put the horizon in the middle, like you were mentioning, you won't even necessarily see any bending. That's obvious.
But they're really neat to use. And one thing you have to be careful of, because the angle of view is so wide, is that if you're using one on a tripod or even handheld, is you can get your feet or the tripod legs in the frame incredibly easily. Yes.
Yeah, and even more likely is getting your own shadow in the shot if you're not careful. I've done it by accident a couple times.
Now, one really neat thing I recently picked up the 10.5 millimeter Nikkor DX fisheye, but mm-hmm. I haven't had a whole lot of opportunity to use it. One thing I really like about it is it focuses really close.
Right.
So you can almost use it as like a macro lens.
Right.
I mean, not really, but if you've ever seen those distorted pictures of animals where, you know, dogs or cats where the whole face is...
I think that was your first shot with the
Oh,
lens,
yeah, you
right?
got to try that out.
Shot
My wife
the dog.
Is happy when I take pictures of the dog. But
you did have the good sense not to take a picture of her with it, though, right?
Right. Yeah. These are not portrait lenses,
no.
folks, unless you really like big noses. So the first rule of fish eyes is just, you know, they're not going to be something that you're going to use all the time, and you have to sort of pick and choose the opportunities to use them.
Yeah.
That being said, they're really neat. And if you're on digital, that 10-5 fisheye lens is so small. It's not hard at all to pack it up.
No, or on film, the same thing is true with the 16 millimeter lens. They're very similar in size and you know, both very lightweight and small.
Right. Now, you don't get, I guess when you're using a fisheye, you can just pretty much forget using any kind of front filters. In fact, most of these fisheye lenses have built-in lens hoods. They don't even have a screw. A threaded screw,
right?
Front filter thread. So forget that, and you wouldn't really want to use a filter with a fisheye lens anyway, because the angle of view is so wide. Something like a polarizer would be really ridiculous, I think.
Yeah, it wouldn't work on that one. Now with color filtration, you know, if you're shooting digital, I would recommend just doing it in Photoshop or your RAW converter or whatever, doing the tweaks there, because it's easier with film. Most fisheyes do have some sort of a slot in the back that'll take gel filters, or some of them have little filters that will either bayonet on or screw on. It just depends on the specific lens that you're working with. And so you can do some things there, like the 16 millimeter lens that I have, you know, the fisheye, came with a little set of filters, I think, like red and yellow, and I can't remember what all. I didn't really use them a whole heck of a lot. With the 10.5, I think it just has a gel slot.
There's a little slot in
yeah.
the back, and it's kind of, you have to unmount the lens, and the slot is in the
yeah. I've
right
never used
the back
that
element.
One either, though.
No, I haven't myself either. Now, one interesting feature if you're shooting digital, and a lot of people have asked us about this, is being able to correct for the fisheye distortion in post processing.
Yeah, it's often called defishing,
and I've tried this, and you can do it. If you use the Nikon 10.5 DX fisheye, and you use either Nikon Capture or Capture NX as your RAW converter, there's a little checkbox that you can do under, I think, lens adjustments. If you're using NX, it's under base adjustments, then click open lens adjustments, and there's a little option called fisheye lens, and if you enable that, it's grayed out unless you're actually using the 10.5 fisheye lens, so most of the time you can't even apply it. And this will reprocess the image, the raw image, to straighten out the distortion. Quite frankly, I don't like that.
Yeah.
In my photography, because first and foremost, you lose a lot of that angle of view. If you it crops out a lot of your image. That's first. And then second of all, the image in the corners isn't going to be nearly as sharp or as nice as if it were the original.
Yeah, and a lot of people will ask, you know, if that's a good option for a wide angle. And I would say, if you're going to use a wide angle a fair amount, get yourself a wide angle, you know, and some
a
of the super wide
lens.
Yeah, some of the super wide zooms are pretty good for using with DX format cameras just because of the sharpness problem. But more importantly, you can't accurately frame your shot. What you see when you look through the viewfinder is the fisheye view, which is 180 degrees and takes in a lot of area. When it defishes, it trims that down,
yeah, you
and
lose
you
a lot
can't
off
accurately
the edges.
Preview it. So it's not a bad thing to have in case of situation where you weren't planning on doing wide-angle shots, but you've got that fisheye and you just need to get a shot and you're not going to blow it up to some big size, then it's not too bad. But as a routine wide-angle, I wouldn't recommend it. There are better options.
And quite frankly, if I'm going to use the fisheye, it's because I want that look.
Right.
I want that interesting,
yeah, same here.
Bizarre fisheye perspective
right.
that you just don't get with a standard wide-angle lens.
Right. Now, we talked about using Capture and Capture NX for defishing. There's some other options out there, too. If you have DxO, there's an option in its 10.5 millimeter lens module to defish. And there's also a tool, I've mentioned it several times in the past, called PT Lens, which is a plugin for Photoshop. Costs just $15. I think it's just PC based.
Yeah, I haven't
there's
found a Mac version yet.
There's some Mac equivalent to it, but I don't know what it is. But PT Lens does a very good job on those conversions. It's not a raw converter, so it's something that's used in Photoshop after you've already done the conversion, but it works well. You know, I did some comparisons with each of those three because those are ones that I had on my PC. And what I found is that in terms of the geometry of the conversion, they all looked the same. There was really no difference in how it did the conversion. The cleanest of the raw converter options was definitely NX, and we'll post some little images. The main thing being that NX did a much better job removing the chromatic aberration that you find with this lens. And the 10.5 does have a fair amount in the corners.
You're going to see that, especially in the corners. And that's where that auto chromatic aberration tool that we've talked about that Nikon Capture and Capture NX has is
really
nice.
It works extremely well, and it definitely produces cleaner images in the corners without having to move sliders around and stuff. The automated settings are very, very good. But, you know, both will produce good stuff. And then PT Lens, like I said, isn't a converter. It just does the geometrical conversion. So the issues with chromatic aberration, you'll have to either manually adjust in that tool, because it does have some features for doing that, or just use Photoshop or, you know, something in ACR if you're doing a raw conversion for that. But you'll want to clean it up. That's the important thing, is plan on cleaning it up, because it'll make a big difference in sharpness.
So you thought those were the two best, the PT Lens and the...
And NX?
NX, yeah.
Yeah, just depending on
quality.
Which path I was going, you know, for a raw conversion.
Okay.
Yeah.
I haven't really tried too much of it. I've only tried it in NX since
I mean, you can make DxO work. You're just going to have to fiddle with its settings to get better color aberration.
I haven't spent too much time with that one lately.
Yeah.
Certainly not since I got the fisheye lens. So.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I think that's... was there anything else we wanted to talk about regarding fisheyes? They're fun.
Right.
You know, it's a fun thing.
Don't overdo it. I mean, when you first get one, you're going to probably overdo it.
Of course, but that's because you got to go out and learn.
And every shot will be a fisheye shot. Have mercy on your friends and family. Don't show them a whole album full of fisheye shots of your last trip. They'll get tired of it in a hurry. That's one thing that's true about fisheyes. A lot of people do buy them, and then they end up gathering dust on the shelf because they get really excited at first, and then they get a little bit burned out on that look. And that's a normal thing. You know, what I would recommend is if you find yourself doing that, pull it out periodically just to revitalize yourself. And it really will throw some interesting twists into your photography.
There's nothing more interesting to me than standing in the center of a room and looking through the viewfinder and seeing both of the walls. I can see three walls,
amazing.
The left, the right, and the one I'm looking at. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So
I think
okay.
those are the main things, though.
Excellent. Well, moving along, we'll spend the rest of our episode today talking about something that we've been playing around
with. Oh, one last thing I should mention.
Oh.
If you have one of the 16mm fisheye lenses that we were talking about and you use it on a digital body, you'll still see some of that fisheye look, but it's going to function as kind of a 24mm fisheye.
Yeah.
So the effect isn't pronounced. It's not gone, and it can still be a useful thing. But it's not going to be nearly as pronounced.
You won't have the 180-degree angle of view because of the crop factor.
No. But you can still do some fun things with that. So if you do have one, give it a try.
Option for that lens.
Mm-mm.
So that's only with that one lens. Okay, cool. So let's talk about black and white, because that's something that we all used to do a long time ago in the dark room. And I think ever since digital came out, I just haven't been messing with black and white.
Although I think it is amazing how many people have never used film.
That's true.
We're seeing more and more messages on the site about people that have just been using digital and now are kind of interested in film. So I never thought I'd see that day where it was kind of the opposite of around what I'm
used to. Once upon a time, I actually processed my own black and white negatives.
Me too.
And used it on larger and made prints out of them.
And it was fun.
And it was pretty cool because you could do a lot of stuff and it's fairly easy to do. The chemistry wasn't too complicated to do at home. But with digital... most people aren't even thinking about black and white. And some cameras have a black and white mode.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always been something lacking from those images.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wasn't sure what that was, what was really lacking. And part of it has to do with the contrast of the image and the tone curve. But real black and white film had sort of two things working for it. It has a huge dynamic range.
Right.
So it just has a different look altogether. And it's usually pretty grainy,
mm-hmm.
especially if you're using something like Tri-X 400 speed, which is sort of the classic, or Plus X 125. But even those had a pretty good amount of grain in it. But they made the pictures look interesting.
Yeah.
They gave them a texture and a certain degree of
atmosphere.
Yeah, it's a nice look.
It is a nice look.
Now,
yeah, photography isn't all about perfection and in the details and, you know, grainless images. Sometimes those defects are great things.
So the easy way, the down and dirty, how do I make my color image that I shot and I've, you know, whether it was a JPEG or a raw image.
Yeah. I'll tell you what. How about this? That? Before we get into the digital thing, let's do something to bridge the gap between the enlarger and the darkroom and digital capture, because there is another option in there too, which is shooting black and white film and scanning it.
That's true.
And I've actually been playing around a little with that lately, partially because I knew that we were going to have a podcast on black and white photography here soon.
That's true. If you have a film scanner or something
right.
that will scan film.
Right. Now, one problem that people are starting to run into is that a lot of places that used to do black and white processing, if you don't want to do it at home, if it's not convenient for you, are not doing it anymore.
Yeah, that's true.
So one of the things I was specifically...
And it's even more expensive now than doing color processing.
Right.
Because they got to set it up the chemistry differently.
Yeah, so one of the things I was playing around with were the... some chromogenic type of films. It's something that uses the same processing as color negatives, you know, what's called the C41 process, mm-hmm. but it's black and white film. And kind of interesting stuff. The stuff I was using was the Kodak, I think it's called T400CN or something like that. And so it's a higher speed black and white film. And it produces some fairly nice things. You can just turn it into anyone that does color negative processing and have them produce prints for you. The prints are made on color paper. So it's very compatible. So that's a very simple way of just trying out some black and white if you've got a film camera. And if you want to make enlargements, then you can go ahead and scan it in your scanner. I've got a couple Nikon scanners, like a lot of people on our site. And so I did a little bit of experimentation there. I used Nikon scan, which is the normal thing I'll use for, you know, doing color scans. Found it didn't work very well. And I tried several of the tricks that I read on the internet, including scanning it as a positive as opposed to a negative and things like that. And frankly, none of them worked very well. What I did find that worked well with that chromogenic film was using ViewScan, which is an alternative scanning tool.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty cheap, and I think you've got it too.
Yeah, I think it cost $40.
Yeah,
but it drives just about every
scanner.
I've had
it for years, so I'm not sure what it sells for.
I've been using it since the late 90s.
Yeah, it's a good scanning tool.
A guy named Ed Hamrick made that. So if you look up Hamrick.
And it's got a bunch of presets for different film types, and it includes the preset for that Kodak film. And I think there's an Ilford equivalent too. And that worked very well. And the scans came out good, and they produced nice prints. And so, you know, that's a decent way of going.
I tried to scan a black and white negative once, and it worked out okay. But if you're using those Nikon film scanners, you need to disable the scratch removal, the
right.
digital ice, because black and white film, I don't know about the chromogenic films, but at least with the regular traditional black and white films, the emulsion on the film itself is got a texture to it, and it will confuse the heck. You'll get this real soft, muddy image
right.
that comes out. So you need to disable the digital ice if your scanner is so equipped.
Yeah, with the chromogenic films, because they're basically the same as color negative films, you don't have that problem.
Okay.
And so you can
cool.
still use the dust and scratch removal, which is handy. Because if that's not enabled, you're going to get scans with lots of junk on them.
Right.
Just from personal experience.
Oh, yeah.
it's amazing. So, you know, that's not a bad way of going. You can also, you know, scan color negative film and do a black and white conversion on it in Photoshop. And so there's several ways mm-hmm. of going there with film.
So assuming you're starting with some sort of digital image, whether you produced it from a scanner or from a camera,
mm-hmm.
which is sort of where I was going, the classic way of converting your image to black and white was to go into Photoshop and change the mode, color mode, from RGB to grayscale.
Yeah.
And there it goes. Mm-hmm. Or just do desaturate. And those never looked very good.
Right.
I mean, they're black and white, but there was just something wrong. And I, like, again, it has to do with the tone and the way when you just convert a color RGB image to a grayscale image, it's, you don't get the, it just doesn't look right.
Right.
It doesn't look the same way as if it were rendered using real black and white film.
Right.
Because black and white film saw colors differently. And that's just something that, so I didn't spend a lot of time doing that. Then I learned a little trick about that you told me about a couple of years ago. It was using the channel mixer function.
Right.
Which was kind of neat. Because at least then you can have some control over the different, how the color red, green, and blue
right.
are converted into black and white.
Yeah, and let's take one more step toward the past, just briefly, because it's a good segue into doing this stuff in Photoshop. What a lot of photographers used with black and white film were color filters that
right.
you know went right on the front of your lens,
like a yellow filter or a red filter.
Or orange or green. Those were probably the most common.
And don't use that with color film.
No, you could, but it'd be a little
be
bit
really
weird. But when you you know, for example, when you see some of those Ansel Adams shots, landscape shots with the really dark sky and the clouds that really jump out at you, those were often made using an orange filter or even a red filter.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the filters work with black and white is they end up darkening their opposite.
Yeah, the complementary color.
Yeah, if you think about the color wheel, if you've ever seen that.
So blue and red's a great example.
Yeah, exactly. And it's cyan and red, mm-hmm. yeah. And so if you want to darken a blue sky, you end up putting on a red filter. And some of the things that are adjacent to that end up darkening things to varying degrees. Like a yellow filter will just give a little bit of darkening to a blue sky. An orange filter, a little bit more. And a red filter, the most.
And conversely, those color filters will tend to lighten mm-hmm. Objects that are the same color as the filter.
Right.
So if you were to use a blue filter, I'll just throw that out there, your sky would look very light.
Right.
Very light. And red objects, though, would appear incredibly dark.
Right.
If you use a green filter, it would lighten foliage. So
right.
there's things you could do
yeah.
like that.
And the whole point of using them is that without them, it's easy to get shots back where different areas and tones just kind of blend into each mm-hmm. other.
There's not a lot of contrast.
Right. You could have an object in your shot that was kind of a medium green and one that was kind of a medium red and one that was, you know, or darker yellow, and they could all end up looking about the same.
Yeah, because the tonality
right,
was about
and you
the
just
same.
Lose all the contrast. So it's a nice way in black and white photography of getting that scene to look the way that you had intended in, from the start and get some separation between areas. And that's the same kind of thing that you end up doing in Photoshop.
Yeah, and these color filters are starting to make their way into the various image processing software packages
mm-hmm.
for specifically for the function of doing a black and white conversion. For example, in Capture NX, they have something that you can use a color filter.
Right. It simulates like yellow or red
or orange or
yeah.
anything you want. There's just a slider. And Photoshop is starting to get that too. So
yeah, just quickly on
black and white is coming, you know, starting to get a life of its own.
Right. We talked a little bit about channel mixer, and in CS2 you can go in there via an adjustment layer or whatever and then move your sliders around, and they're
yeah, you
different
go to,
colors, and you can do the same basic thing. That
in Photoshop, you click Image, and then Adjustments, and then you pull down Channel Mixer, or you can also do it from an adjustment layer.
Mm-hmm.
And then it pulls up a little dialog box with the Channel Mixer. And
you want
then,
to tick the little box that says Monochrome.
Yeah, there's a little button on the bottom left corner that says Monochrome. And when you do that, it converts your image to black and white. And then you have a red, green, blue slider, and then a slider at the bottom called constant.
Mm-hmm.
And the slider on the bottom will adjust the overall brightness
right.
of the image. And then these red, green, and blue channels will you can just play around with and see what happens to your image.
Right. Now, the one of the rules for you or guidelines for using Channel Mixer was that if you what you want to do is keep the red, the green, and the blue slider amounts, and they're in percentages, adding up to 100. And in that case, you'll end up with something that's the same basic brightness. If you don't do that, you'll change the brightness. So if you just dial down the red, the overall image may shift in that direction, but you'll also get something that's darker. So you'll want to do a little bit of arithmetic in your head to keep them adding up to about 100. You can also use that constant slider to help with those adjustments.
Yeah, and it can be, I mean, it's fun, but it's certainly an inexact science.
Right. Now, the new version of Photoshop, we talked a little bit about in the last episode, which is CS3, has a really cool thing that you can do as an adjustment layer for black and white conversions, and it's called black and white, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to having some of the same basic features that Channel Mixer had, it's got more colors to play with.
So red, yellow, green, cyan, blue, magenta. I just pulled
right, right. And it's also got some presets for, you know, some of the things that we were talking about, yellow filters, red filters, green filters, etc. But the really amazing thing, I think, is you can actually, while you've got this adjusting palette up, you can go to your image, and then by simply dragging your mouse to the left and right in an area, it will automatically adjust the color band that corresponds to that area. So, for example, right now Jason's got a picture of his parrot up, and if he goes to an area that's red on the original image and moves his mouse cursor back and forth, it'll automatically know that that's the red band that he wants to adjust and then either brighten it or darken it. So it's very intuitive and cool. So that's a thing to look forward to in the new CS3.
Yep, and, you know, of course, there's also some nice little presets in there, too, so like green filter, red filter, so you can do that.
Yep.
Now, the toughest part about Channel Mixer was getting the sliders to add up to 100%.
Right.
So, because it doesn't have a way of constraining them.
Mm-hmm.
This concept with the channel sliders is also in the Capture NX.
Mm-hmm.
There's a black and white conversion. You can do a color filter, and you can change the strength of that. And it sort of works where there's a little spectrum, and you can slide the slider over that. And then there's also some presets as well under the base adjustments in the, where you would change color mode, say, from color mode 1 to color mode 3. You could also change it to black and white mode, and it has filter presets, orange, green, etc., etc. So you can do that at the raw conversion level, or you can just convert from a TIFF or a JPEG that you've already saved. And it's pretty neat. The last thing that we came across, what was that, about
a long time
like
ago,
February or March of last year, back in 06, when we were just newbies doing this, we reviewed an interesting product from Alien Skin Software called Exposure. And it has a whole... its job, it plugs into Photoshop CS or CS2, and its job is to emulate film. And it has a whole side of it that just does black and white conversion.
Right.
And its presets are actually to specific film types, Tri-X, Plus X, all kinds of different infrared. And it has it all in sort of one-stop shopping. You pull up this module, and you can do it. And the thing I liked about it is that it has the same channel mixer function, but you can check off a little box that says constrain so that they always sum up to 100%. So when you move one slider to the right, other sliders automatically move to the left to balance out the brightness of the image properly.
And you can turn it off if you want, but it's very handy. And then it does a very good grain emulation.
Right. That's the thing that I really enjoy. And something about a black and white image that when I see one, I want to see grain in it.
Right.
Maybe that's just because I'm used to seeing those from days with film, but you put a little film grain in there, and I don't like the film grain filter in Photoshop, but I really like the film grain emulator from Alien Skin's Exposure.
Yeah,
it just looked more natural for some reason.
Yeah, now if you're using that tool, the assumption that they've made is that the original image that you're processing in with Exposure is one that is a lot like what comes out of the ACR raw converter when set to its default settings. In other words, it's a low contrast image, as opposed to one with, you know, a normal amount of contrast.
Especially for the color presets.
Yeah, so if you're really trying to get something that looks like Tri-X, you want to start with something that's of lower contrast to begin with. Otherwise, it'll just look too pronounced. And the same thing is true with its color conversions, too. But, you know, that's a different subject.
Yeah.
Now, there are some other alternatives out there, too. The people that make PhotoKit, the Pixel Genius people, in addition to making PhotoKit Sharpener, also have a thing called PhotoKit, and it includes some black and white conversions. Same basic things that we've been talking about, color filters and things like that. So that's another one that's out there.
I would say, unless you're really going to do this on a serious basis, start off by just playing with your channel mixer in Photoshop, because it's there and it's built in, and it'll do this for you.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have a lot more creative control over the output of the image.
Now, if you're using DxO, there is a new plugin set of things for it. It's called Film Pack or something like that. And in addition to emulating some color film types, it will also emulate some black and white conversions. And I've tried that a little bit, and it does do a good job with those black and white conversions. So that's an option for you DxO users.
Nice. Well, that's sort of the...
Oh, one last thing that we should talk about.
Yeah.
Some Nikon cameras do have a black and white setting on them. And I know the D200 has that, the D2X, D2HS, D2XS, and I think the D80 maybe.
Yeah. If you have a D2X, you need to upgrade your firmware to get to the 2.0.
Right. And a lot of people have said, well, you know, what's the point of those? I can always do the conversion in Photoshop. And certainly you can. But here's the way that feature is nice in situations where you're intending the final product to be black and white. What you can do is, if you want, you can shoot in RAW and JPEG mode, and then what will happen is all the JPEGs that you produce will be in black and white. And so when you pull up a contact sheet or something like that, you'll see your images all converted to black and white. Now, it's not the fancy black and white with all the filtration and stuff that we talked about, so they may not be, you know, in their final form. But it's a nice, easy way to see your images in black and white quickly and easily without doing any conversions on there. So it's a handy thing at times.
And then what's cool about that is that if you shot in RAW, you can always go back and make them color.
Exactly.
And that's kind of the best of both worlds. So you might have a shot that doesn't work for black and white, but it ended up working great for, for color.
Yeah.
Now, the last little bit on black and white, and it's part of the reason why I didn't do a lot of black and white, is at
printing.
Some point you like to print them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's fine to have a black and white image, but at some point you usually want to make a print of the thing. And color inkjet printers for a really long time just, they don't do a good job making black and white. You have two options typically when you're using a color inkjet printer. You can print the image using the black cartridge in monochrome mode. And that works okay in terms of the tone. You get a nice black and white image, but it's really, you don't get a lot of nice, smooth tone gradations because you're only using one printhead, and so it can't generate those nice, clean gradients from black to gray to white because you only have black ink, and that's all it can do. Your other option was to emulate black and white using the color. Just print it in color, but it prints it out as a grayscale image. And in theory, that should work just fine. In practice, it never really does.
Right. Because what it would do is it would take the color inks and mix them together to get a gray.
And while that should work...
It was close, but depending on the specific printer that you had, sometimes you'd have a greenish tinge, sometimes a little bit of a magenta tinge. It just never looked quite neutral, especially if you were comparing it against a real black and white print.
Yeah, it just didn't look good, and so that was a frustration for me. Now, if you have a really good printer profile or use a RIP software, that's one way of potentially getting around that. Now, RIP software is pretty expensive stuff, and you're not going to just use that for your $99 printer. there's some other options you can do, though, now to achieve better black and white prints.
Yeah, and a lot of the newer printers that are out, and they're made by Epson and Canon and HP, have additional ink cartridges in them. So in addition to the color ones in black, a lot of them include a couple shades of gray as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're making a black and white print, then the printer driver usually has an option for doing a black and white, and then it will mix those two shades of gray plus the black and white, and you'll get very nice looking black and white prints.
Yeah, the best example of that is the Epson stylus. Was it 2400?
Yeah,
uses that. There's the R1800, the which also prints wide images. It doesn't have as many shades of gray, so there's a difference there in terms of. I know there's a big difference in price between the 1800 and the 2400. If you're shooting mostly color and you only want to print color, the 1800 is a great deal because it's got good output. If you do black and white, the 2400 might be a better printer. And then beyond that, you know, anything that uses those K3 inks from Epson will do excellent black and whites.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the name K3, K is the abbreviation for black ink, CMYK. K is black. K3 means three blacks.
Right.
So there's black, light black, and light black. And you can do that. I've tried it now with my new printer, and it's really good.
Yeah, it does do
it. It's absolutely neutral.
Right.
There's no color cast to it whatsoever.
Yeah.
It comes out great.
Probably for the absolute best black and white prints, you're going to want to use the traditional darkroom processes and enlargers and as big of negative as you can get. But you can do pretty well using digital capture conversions like we were talking about and one of the newer printers.
Yeah. Now, there's one other printing option that I've seen used, and that is taking a printer that you have and converting it to black and white only.
Right.
So say you have a six-color printer or even just a four-color printer. There are companies out there, I think Lyson is one of these companies that does it, where they sell just black and white inks. You got to use the right profiles, and it converts, and you install cartridges. You got to clean everything out, and you install just black and shades of gray cartridges into your printer. This is not something you'd really want to do and swap out back and forth. But if you were to, say, have an older printer or a second printer that you wanted to dedicate to black and white printing only, that you can truly get some nice output from one of those using the appropriate profiles, because there's a lot of different, and you can do quad tones and all kinds of other crazy stuff with those too.
Right.
But that's really the only way to get really good inkjet output, is to have multiple shades of black and you're printing and just forego the color altogether.
And then paper type can be an influence on the results too. Normally, if I'm doing color, I'll stick with the luster paper, which is, you know, kind of an in-between thing, in between glossy and matte. I don't really like matte a whole lot for most color shots. It's just way too muted. But I like matte paper for black and white. And you might try playing around a little bit with some of the different paper types out there. There are a bunch of them. But it can be a very nice look for black and white that's a little bit different than what you'll find
with glossy. And the matte papers tend to have the longest archival ratings as well, at least on the Epson inks. I don't know about the other ones.
But. Yeah, so with some of the newer printers, the combination of those papers and the newer inks gives you very good archival qualities.
So you could, in theory, make museum-quality prints.
Yeah.
So that brings us to the last thing, our last quick hit of this episode, and that's our tip of the day. And you wanted to talk about how to get a polarizing filter effect using control points in Capture NX.
Yeah, and briefly talk about other tools too, but that'll be the way that we really talk about it, is doing it in X.
Work whether you shot RAW or JPEG or TIFF, because NX can read TIFFs and JPEGs and use the color control points on it.
Yeah, and basically the way this came up is the other day I was playing around with some images that I had taken while I was on a trip over to England. It was a business trip, and I just took a small amount of stuff, and because I really didn't think I'd get a chance to do anything. Turned out I ended up with a free day, and I was not too far away from the Lake District in England, so I went up there with a friend of mine, and he and I drove through that area, and of course it's absolutely gorgeous. I mean, it's a beautiful area, but I didn't have a polarizer with me, And so I got my shots back, and they were fine. I mean, they were kind of snapshots, so I wasn't there at a good time of the day or whatever. But, you know, there was a little bit of haze in the sky, and some of the distant hills and stuff weren't coming through really well. So what I ended up doing, and I was using NX to do the conversion, is first I put a color point on the sky, and I did have some blue sky. And you have to have that to pull this off. And with that control point on the sky, first I adjusted it so it, you know, was picking up the whole sky. You can do two control points if you're having problems getting even coverage. And then I just dialed down the brightness a little bit. You don't want to overdo it. And then I took a second color control point and put it on the hillside. Just an area where I had some foliage and, you know, grass and whatever. Kind of a medium-toned part of the hillside. And then for there, rather than dialing down the brightness, I increased the contrast. The color points in NX have three sliders. There is brightness, contrast, and saturation.
At least those are the defaults.
Right.
You can pull up a lot more, but...
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
There's, I'll have to look at that.
You can pull up all kinds of stuff on those control points, but you have to do that from inside the palette.
You learn something new.
That's a different...
Yeah.
I thought you read my book.
I kind of looked at it.
Oh, okay.
So you adjust that contrast slider and just bump it up a little bit, and... what you'll find is that the combination of the two, if you now turn on and off the control points, it'll give you a look that's a lot like a polarizer. The sky's a little bit darker. The haze is really cut on that hillside area. It's amazing how good a job it actually does. And it looks a heck of a lot like a tastefully used polarizer. So just a little tip for situations where you may not have had a polarizer or just an alternative way of doing it. It's not too bad.
Yeah, it's cool.
It's not going to remove reflections and things like that.
No, you can't. There's some things that you just can't substitute, and that's why we recommend a polarizer. If you only have one filter, that's the one to have.
Yeah.
But it is pretty cool, and those control points can be quite useful.
Yeah, works remarkably well. If you're trying to do this in Photoshop, what you'll want to do is either select the sky or do some masking and darken it down. And then in the hillside area, do a similar kind of selection one way or another, and then put on a curve or something like that. And, you know, have it isolated just to that hillside area, mask out the other parts. And you can do it. It's not as quick as and easy as doing an NX, but you could certainly do it.
Certainly doable. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, excellent. Well, that sort of brings us to the end of the show, I guess.
Yep.
Well, darn. Another 2 weeks gone by, and we still have more things we could probably talk about.
Yep.
And what those things are going to be next time, I don't know.
Yep.
But we'll think. But we're always looking for suggestions for shows. I know we've gotten some good suggestions, and those of you who have emailed us at talkradio@nikonians.org, keep those suggestions coming. We do have those emails from you, and we do plan on using some of those topics soon. Part of it has been getting better weather here, so we can do our R1C1. Part of it is waiting for some parts to arrive. I got some little soft boxes that I'm hoping to connect and try out some real low-budget studio lighting with SB800s, but I'm waiting on the last part to show up. So until I get those things, I can't really test that now, can I?
Not too well.
It makes it harder.
Yeah.
But keep your suggestions coming. And until next time, we hope you have good shooting.
Bye-bye.